Trayi Sankhyang Yoga Pashupatimatang Vaishnavamiti Prabhinne Prasthane Paramidamada Patyamiti Cha Ruchinam Vaichitriyad Rijukutilanana Patajusham Nrinameko Gamyas Tvamasi Payasam Arnava Iva. O Lord, as all the streams, different streams of the world, arising from their different sources and traveling by different paths, all mingle at last in the same sea, so, O Lord, do the paths which men take according to their different tendencies, following different scriptures, all at last, as however different they may appear, crooked or straight, arrive at Thee and Thee alone. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhetamastu, Ma Vindushavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill
to study together the art of spirituality.
May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Peace 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 be unto us all. The announced subject for today is to forgive, but to forget? Questionable. And I'm going to start by telling you an unpleasant truth, perhaps. If you feel the need to be forgiven or to forgive, that's a spiritual failure. We should be invulnerable. After all, we are the ever-living divine spirit. Nobody can touch us, nobody can hurt us if we know who we are. If we are aware of our own inner nature, our own complete transcendence of all things, time, worthy or relative. We should not be afraid of what anyone says or does to us. It's because we lose track and forget our true nature that we feel the need to forgive and to be forgiven. Most especially to forgive, of course. So it's a sign of spiritual failure that we even have to raise this question. I want you to understand that in the beginning. I'm going to come back to it at the end, after going through a lot of other talk. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote a book called The Insulted and Injured. Wonderful title. And it was a great novel, a long, long book about all kinds of people who were insulted and injured and what they did about it and how it ruined their lives or how they overcame it, so on. That's a wonderful title. We are all insulted and injured most of the time. But after you're insulted and injured, then what? How do you do it? How do you get over it? Can we be forgiven? Yes, we can be forgiven. And that's what we want to explore this morning, how we can be forgiven and how we can forgive. So, what is the program for learning to forgive? We want very much to be loved. We want to be admired. We want to be accepted. We want to be approved. At least we want to be accepted. That's the minimum. And beyond that, all these other things come. Being admired, being loved, being cherished, being wanted, and so on. And when those things fail us, then we are indeed in difficulty. And most of all, I think we want just to be noticed. That, you know, there's that famous actress who said, "I don't care whether they say good about me or bad about me in the papers, just so long as they're talking about me." We want to be noticed. We want to be taken account of. We want to feel that we are somebody in this world. Of course, we are nobody in this world, but that's not the way we look at it. We're looking at it from our ego, and we want to be somebody in this world, at least. Well, I think the first point that I would make on getting ourselves forgiven would be to remember that our being forgiven is not contingent upon the other person's, our forgiving is not contingent upon the other person's asking for it. If you want to forgive someone and you're cherishing constantly in your heart this idea, well, let him come and ask me to be forgiven, let him apologize, let her apologize, let her come. And you may be waiting the rest of your life, because our forgiveness does not at all depend and is not contingent upon the attitude of the other person. That's one of the most important things to remember. There was a book written called, with the title, What Others Think of You is None of Your Business. What Others Think of You is None of Your Business. It's a good one. It's a good title. It tells you that you don't have to wait to find out how others feel about it before forgiving them. There are people who would rather die than come to you and ask for forgiveness. There are. There are people who, that's the last thing on earth that they're going to do, is to come and ask to be forgiven for what they've done to you. You have to make allowance for that. These people have to be acknowledged. Your forgiveness is a matter for you to decide and not depend upon their attitude. That's the most important thing. In Vedanta, we take a very positive response to everything we say, that we take possession of our feelings, possession of our thoughts, possession of our reactions. All these are in my court. All of the things which happen to me are, and responses which I make to them, according to Vedanta, are ours to take care of. We have the ball in our court, and we have to play it, and we cannot go on cherishing the idea that somebody else has got to make the first move. It's not a chess game where somebody else has the opening. You have the opening. Always, in every case, you have the opening. There's a woman named Carolyn Meese, or is it Mice? I don't know how it's pronounced. Mice? M-Y-S-S. And if you know of her books or anything about her teachings, You will understand why I am bringing her into it. I haven't read a lot of Carolyn Mice's work, but I know that she has done some very nice counseling and given us some very nice advice. And this is what she says. You can take it or leave it. I'm sure you'll find it difficult to take, but anyway, here it is. You should thank the people who put thorns into your life, in your body, in your life, who give you thorns because they show us that we value their opinions more than we value our own. Think about that. Just think about that. We value their opinion. We regard how they look upon us higher than our own opinions. If we stuck to ourselves and didn't try to wait for what others think about us, we'd be much better off from the very beginning. Why would we be upset by what other people think of us if we did not consider that their opinions were very important? It's a very good point. She makes a very good point. And Swami Vivekananda often tells us in so many words, you learn more from your mistakes than from your successes. Be grateful. You learn more from your enemies than from your friends. Be grateful to the people who pick on you and who insult and injure you, because they are incentives for you to grow spiritually. You have to incorporate within your consciousness the experience of that injury. You have to go beyond it. You have to grow out of it. You have to pass over it and encompass it in your total purview of the past. This is my past. This is gone. This is not now. This is not in the future. This is my past. Let it go. To be able to do that, you see, requires to be able to accept the idea that those who appear to be enemies, it's all appearance, those who appear to be enemies and who seem to be inimical and injure us are doing us favors. Well, there are three kinds, I should say, there are probably three kinds of forgiveness. One is the forgiveness of others. We forgive others for what they've done to us or we think they've done. Forgiving of God. Why did he do this to me? I can't forgive God for his behavior toward me. You hear this sometimes. Very many, many people have to learn to forgive God. And then, of course, there is the forgiveness of oneself. I believe that that's the most difficult. I find in my old age, as I've become older, that the most difficult form of forgiveness is the form of forgiving myself. There are a number of reasons for that. I'll come along to them perhaps later. But right now, I think what we're concerned with, there was a South Dakota Native American who lived in South Dakota who said about self-forgiveness that it really is not possible. It requires divine power. All the other kinds of forgiveness are within your scope, the possibility of forgiving. But to forgive yourself, he says, is a very difficult thing, which requires divine power to accomplish. I'm not certain he isn't right. I think that may be quite correct. Well, approaching the problem of forgiving others, first principle is to understand. My teacher, my Swami, my guru, used to watch people going into various kinds of tizzies problems. And he would say quietly, almost under his breath, "Understand and adjust. Understand and adjust." Wonderful formula. It's a wonderful formula. Understanding is the key to forgiveness. Can you put yourself in the place of the other person successfully? Have you tried really to understand your foe or your injurer, your adversary? Because if you have, you can probably decrease the injury's intensity by a great degree. It is misunderstanding almost always that leads to the feeling of injury, to the sense of injury, and the failure of communication. The failure of communication. Difficult, very difficult to communicate. But we have to try and try and try again. Humble ourselves enough to go and say, I didn't understand, maybe I was wrong. Maybe you saw something I didn't see. Let's get into discussion about it, let's talk about it. You see these things in the comics, you know. I read the Sunday comics on Sunday night, and at a place where I go, and I'm always seeing these things. Dagwood, Blondie and Dagwood, and those army people. Everything that's funny in those comics is as a result of somebody's misunderstanding. The boss sees Dagwood in one way, Blondie sees him in a totally different way, his neighbor sees him in another way, and all of the conflicts and problems and funny situations arise through lack of communication, through failure to understand. Now that's fine in the comics, but when it takes a serious turn and becomes a matter of injury, and then it becomes very important to get to the bottom of things and really understand. It takes time and it takes trouble to work through the misunderstandings that have given us our complexes about injury. It takes time and understanding. It takes willingness, a little willingness on both sides. But if you're the one who has to make the overture, if you're the one who has to take the responsibility, and each of us as a Vedantist is saddled with that responsibility to take the initiative. And if you have to do that, then you have to be more more understanding, more forgiving, more ready to talk than the other person. The other person may not show any readiness at all, as I already indicated. Somebody has said, I think it was Emerson or somebody said, only the brave can afford to forgive, the coward never. Only the brave can afford to forgive, the coward never. Well, let's go on to another statement. I can forgive her or him. Let's make it feminine. I can forgive her, but I can never forget. And my response to that is, are you kidding? Can you really forgive if you can't forget? Do you think really that if you have not forgotten, you have forgiven? I don't think so. Let's talk about it a little bit. I'm not talking about hypocrites. I don't mean hypocrites. I mean sincere people. People who sincerely believe that having forgiven, as they so think, they will now be unable to forget. Psychology shows, psychologists have shown, that we tend to drop out from our consciousness the more unpleasant aspects of our life. You may not believe that, because the injuries, the hurts were so deep, and those trauma were so drastic, that you felt you'd had lots of misery in your life. But psychological tests have shown that we tend to remember the pleasant things and drop out the unpleasant. I've just come from a visit to Seattle, and I realized that on the way back in the plane, I was gradually shuffling off the little things, unpleasant or critical remarks that I'd made to myself, and all I was remembering was the perfect weather, the places that we went, the happy conversations that we had, the wonderful food. I was spoiled up there, and all of that that I could, that was what I wanted to keep, and that's what I wanted to bring home. That's what I remembered. And the rest of it didn't matter. So when things really do prick and hang in there, that's where the problem comes. Most of the things that happen to us, if they're unpleasant, we tend to drop them out. Now, when you say, I can never forget, let's make a very clear distinction between remembering, or let's say, between memory and remembering. Because psychology has also shown that there are very few things that happen to us that we once register in our consciousness. Call it subconscious or unconscious, whatever your school of psychology wants to call it. Deep down in the levels of our mind, these things have lodged and they remain there. And once they have gone there, it's not at all likely that they disappear. In fact, many psychologists say that they never disappear. So, rather than say, I can never forget, which may be true in its ultimate sense, ultimately may be true, why not say, I have forgiven her and I will stop remembering? Because it's when you bring it up again and again and again. That you know you have not forgotten. But if you left it there and didn't constantly fan the flames out of egoistic feeling or out of it's all ego, resentment, you call it by different names. And all of those things, resentment, ego, come up. For those reasons, we keep fanning the flames of this sore, this wound, and bring it up and look at it again. Ah, oh, that rascal. Oh, what he did. Oh, how did he ever dare to do that to me? And so on and so forth. Me. And it's the remembering that is our problem, not the fact that it has lodged in our memory. Because, as I said, don't think that we can really forget. This is the evidence for this. If the thing has been important to us, and if it has been dramatic, and we thought at the time that it was important, then it becomes registered, and that it's still there is proved by three things. One is hypnosis. Hypnosis can demonstrate that there are things lying in the subconscious which you have forgotten or appeared to have forgotten, and that they're there, and that they can be brought back by the suggestion of the hypnotist, who allows you to sink into slightly lower layers of the waking state. By the way, hypnosis belongs to the waking state, not to the dream state. We talked about waking dream and dreamless sleep. I don't know if I mentioned at that time, hypnosis is a variation of the waking state. It's not a dream state. So the hypnotist comes and rescues these things, and maybe you want to launder them, you don't know. From dreams we discover that old impressions have lodged there. We sometimes dream the same frightful dream over and over, showing that there's been a trauma in the subconscious that has centered around something of that kind. And most of all, most important, is therapy. A psychotherapist, psychoanalysts and so on, ask you to explore what we call the citta. The citta is the memory bank, the bank of memories, which is one form of the mental substance. Our antakarana, I won't go into those details this morning, but we have an inner organ, which is called the antakarana. And the antakarana has different functions. And one of its functions is to make a storage bank, and that's called the citta. And so it is in the citta that the therapist tries to work and find your old injuries and bring them up. And that you find them. You find that they're there. Old Aunt Emma gave me a patty whacking when I was a kid, and as a result of which I cherish a very ill image of her all the rest of my life. And she might have been a very sweet old lady, but I won't know it because I have this image of her in my citta, and it keeps coming back when I refer to it. You know, the phenomena of old age, this business of, oh, I remember perfectly what happened when I was 7 years old and I was sliding down the banister and I fell off and hit the floor. I remember when I was swimming, I was about 9 years old, and I was swimming and I fell off a raft and I went down for the third time and a little girl came and rescued me. These things I can tell you about, but ask me about what happened 2 weeks ago, and I'm getting to the age where I'm not quite sure about that. Short-term memory goes as age comes on. This is important, the study of memory. So what's this got to do with forgiveness? You need to know what memory is all about. It's important. So the older person, the person who is getting into senility, is unable to tell you about what happened yesterday or day before, maybe, or just even an hour ago, but can tell you many things about what happened in the cherry orchard in 1906, and all of the things that they can remember from the earliest of their impressions. Well, there are many reasons for that. One of them is that when we are very young and have not filled our citta, our mental substance, it's material. It works like material. And when you haven't filled it with a lot of different impressions, those few impressions that you're gathering when you're very young stand out. They occupied a space which was relatively vacant, and they become, therefore, they take up larger space. They become, larger and loom larger. When you get to older age, as I'm beginning to feel now, you look more and more for meaning. And what happened an hour ago, or a day ago, or 2 weeks ago, unless it has importance for my life now, I'm going to tend to drop it out. Meaning is what old people look for because they've spent a whole lifetime not finding it. You've spent your whole life not finding the meaning of this world. Going into different corners, following different paths, pursuing different goals and ends, having different experiences. We sang this morning, take away from me the illusion of this world. There can't be a greater prayer. There cannot be a greater prayer than take away from me the illusion of this world. It's in this illusory world that we do not find real meaning. And having not found real meaning for so many, many years, the older person wants and approaches death with a search, a deeper search for the meaning. What is this coming and going, if you believe in reincarnation? What is this coming and going? Dying again, born again, dying again, born again. So that is one of the things that we find in analysis. Analysts often use word association. And you know, Vedanta gives great importance to the word. We think that everything lies in the word itself. This universe was created out of a word, a thought, or a word. That's one of the principles of the Upanishads. They go back to the Vedic times. The Upanishads often tell us that the whole universe came out of a word. Or if you go to the New Testament, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So that's a standard principle in all mysticism, that the Word has extreme importance for us, and the power of a word can trigger associations of innumerable kinds and of very drastic and damaging kinds if we're not careful about looking upon it in the right way. Holy Mother made a very interesting observation. Somebody asked her, Mother, what is the matter with my meditation? Why is it that when I try to meditate, all I get is these old memories, associations, things I don't want to look at all. And she said, my child, our sanskaras are the impressions through which we have lived, the things through which we have lived, are like thread wound on a spool. And we wind and wind the spool, these impressions wind up. Now, when you go to meditate, when you try to become Brahman, she didn't use that word, when you try to realize God, you unroll the spool goes in the other direction, and all of these things come reeling off, and you have to look at them again, you have to see them there. If you pay too much attention to them, you're sunk. So don't. Don't look at them. Don't pay much attention to those things. Don't come and tell the Swami, oh, I had this horrible past. It all came back to me. What am I going to do? I'm a sinner. Forget it, you know. It's like photonegatives. Someone else has likened the experience of repetition of memories to the negatives of in photography. We have this negative, and from that negative, copy after copy after copy in color can be made. And our experiences come out again, highly colored, or maybe black and white. But the negative is there, lying in the citta. And from that negative, copies are made, and they come up, and they come back, and we have to deal with them. And we cannot probably totally eradicate that negative until our mind itself dissolves. And that comes only at the very end of spiritual life. The mind is dissolved and all these things become unimportant. Sometimes in analysis, the patient will say, "I just can't recall. I just can't recall." Try to tell me. the analyst is saying, "Try to tell me about such and such a situation." But that's the part I can't remember. I just can't recall. I can't remember this. And yet we know that it's there. So what is happening? Fear, repression, these things are blocking it. The thing is too painful. It's too painful to look at again, perhaps. There are people who cannot bring up the experiences which they would like to forget and forgive because they're too painful. And they're painful because of our sensitivity, our ego sensitivity. We are the insulted and the injured, and we know it. And so even some of these memories that bring that bring our difficulty, we cannot bring up. And so it lies there and festers like a tooth, like a rotting tooth. It sits there and festers and causes even physical disease. I think you know. Now, how many kinds of physical diseases have been traced to the unconscious or subconscious festering of some sore that we don't want to explore, we don't want even to understand, and we may not be able to understand why we react to a certain person in a certain way. Every time I see her, I cringe. Or every time he comes across my path, I run away. You find that kinds of experiences all the time in life with forgiving and forgetting. And we don't know why. We don't know why we're thinking that way, feeling that way. Because this rankling goes on inside of us. But having talked about psychoanalysis and its advantages and its methods, I have to say from a Vedantic standpoint that probably psychoanalysis and psychology make too much of repression. I think repression is something of a red herring. Children of 50 or 40 or 50 years ago were given a kind of psychology training which released their inhibitions. Who was that great American educational philosopher, educational psychologist, whose ideas covered a couple of generations of children? I can't think. See, I'm getting to a place where now I can't think of the name.
Rogers?
No. This is before that. Educational psychology. Oh, well, doesn't matter. I'll just tell you the story anyway. Schools were all organized according to his... I should have looked it up.
Anyway.
Dewey. Thomas E. Dewey. Not Thomas E. Dewey. The other Dewey.
John Dewey.
40 or 50 years ago, John Dewey's ideas pertained and pervaded the whole of educational system. I remember it very clearly. And I was living at one time in a house, I was boarding and rooming in a house as a high school student. And my landlady had a number of precious plants in pots on the back porch. She cherished them and took very good care of them, of course. And one day, she came in and found that somebody had come in and smashed several of the pots, just made ruckus all over the back porch. And, of course, she came in and loudly protested and complained about it. She said, "You know, I know who did that. Those are the children of our neighbor. Those are the little children of our neighbor, the psychology professors at the university, who have follow the teachings of Dewey." And she said, "They have been brought up to follow their own inclinations and not to repress themselves." And she said, I'll never forget it, the way she said it. "I don't care what they do in their own home, but in my back porch they will not follow their own inclinations." So there was a whole period of educational psychology where repression was boogeyman. But how can you follow a spiritual life? How can you follow any kind of spiritual practice, do sadhana or anything, if you don't do a certain amount of repressing? We don't call it repression. We try not to make it something that, like a jack-in-the-box, you push it down and no time before it'll come up again. That would be relatively foolish. It would be almost inexcusable. But respect and reverence we have to have for other people's possessions, for other people, for everything about them. Swami Prabhavananda was one of my great abbots, and he said once, "We are all animals. Every one of us has the animal nature. And we are all the time feeling the impulse to speak up, to say and to do things which are relatively antisocial." I was surprised to hear him say that, because he was so obviously a beautifully controlled spiritual person, a spiritual man. But he said, we all have these antisocial, animalistic tendencies, and they're just lying beneath the surface. The sign of a civilized person is that he or she learns to keep those impulses under control. If that doesn't require repression, I don't know what it is. You don't have to call it repression. I mean, you can call it self-control. But that was amazing to me, that he would say that we all have this beast within us, growling, coming to the surface, poking his head up. And we have to say, "Down, Fido," and keep them in the social realm, keep them in the social social approval. Well, here are some other suggestions that come from other sources that I know of. Always try to remember, we change. Our personalities change, our minds change, our feelings change, our emotions and our values change as we grow, as we mature spiritually, and others change too. And one of the best suggestions that I have ever come upon is this. Take out the memories carefully with a sense of detachment. Carefully take out from your memory, for examination, the trauma which most disturbs you, or those which most disturb you. Let's take one and look at it again in today's light. How much do you think you have changed since that happened? Have you not matured? Have you not understood more? Can you not look back at that person or that event and say, I didn't realize so-and-so, such-and-such, how pressed he or she was, impinged upon by such-and-such forces. I see now what the situation was in which he found himself and why he felt he had to say this. You can do this, and I've done it, and I think it can be done very successfully if you keep a spirit of detachment, if you don't allow yourself to get emotionally involved too much. You can take it out and look at it and go back over it and do I really remember how that was done? What happened on that occasion? Is my memory now as good as it was then? And maybe I've misremembered over the years how exactly that occasion arose. What really happened at that time? You know, police reports. The police collect these reports from different people who witness an accident, and you know how many of those are different. How different some of those are. I've seen some of the police reports of my accident where the injured party, or myself, were so far apart on the description of what happened. It's shocking. It's shocking how our own mind colors the event that took place. So take this out and look at it and see. Do I have to forgive? Maybe there wasn't anything there that required forgiveness. Maybe I misunderstood. Maybe today I can see it differently. This doesn't always work, I have to assure you. There's some things that you can't do this with, but I think there are many that you can, and I suggest that possibility. Another question: what if insults come up of themselves, as for instance in meditation? Well, we've already talked about that a little bit. We are meditating and these things come up, the past impressions. So for some reason, the time of our quiet, our meditative, contemplative time, is just the time when these wild dogs and demons want to come up. And when that happens, there are two things that I think you can do. I would suggest two different recourses. If you're strong, strong-minded, you can brush them aside and say, no entry. This mind is occupied with a very important job. It's working on a very important project. No entry to those thoughts. You block them out. If you're of a more devotional nature, may not be able. What do you call it when something is totally, totally phony? The idea that the devotee is the weak person and the gyani, or the gyani is the strong person. It may not be so at all. Sometimes the devotee is stronger. But anyway, if you can't just turn them aside, take those thoughts, those interruptions, and you're meditating, if you're a devotee, you're meditating on God, some form of God. Take them, put them in your hands, and lay them at the feet of the Lord, and say, these are yours, not mine. Somehow they came from you, because you are the source of everything. And so back to you they come, and you will have to deal with them. I cannot manage them. They came from you, and you, they bugged my mind, and now they come back to you because they are yours. This sometimes, what does Jesus say? If you come to the altar and you want to make your offering, and you remember something that you have done somebody some wrong, or you have some grudge to solve, go and settle your hash, settle the argument, and come back and bring your offering. Don't try to come with a mind which has not forgiven or been forgiven. And so that's a good suggestion too. And then we have this suggestion too, that if it's not possible for you to do either of those things, do what Ram Prasad, the poet, the Bengali poet, did. He said, "My mind, you are totally without my control. You do not know how to farm. You are hopeless. I lay my mind at my whole mind, the one that tries to meditate and the one that tries to shut out the obstructions. I take that whole mind and I lay it at your feet. I lay it at Mother's feet," he said, "my whole mind as an offering, because I cannot do anything with it." Well, here's another way you might appeal to you. When I was in my last year of high school, I went to a retreat that was held by our church. And there came to that retreat an Austrian psychologist. Maybe you've heard of him. Fritz Kunkel. Kunkel was a student of Jung and a student of Freud. I think he was more a student of Freud than a student of Jung. But he came and gave us a nice talk, and this is what he told people to do when they felt injured. He said, go into a room where you have a piece of old stuffed furniture, ratty and unconcerning, you're not concerned with, and go into the room. You've got a grudge against Aunt Emma, what she did to you when you were a child. Go into the room and address this overstuffed chair and say, "I dub thee Aunt Emma," and pound it till all your energy, with all your energy, pound it to death. I don't know whether that's a good way or not. Not only it's hard on the furniture, but I don't think it really helps you spiritually. At least it saves Aunt Emma. Better, I think, is to avoid new complexes. Say to yourself, past is past. Don't make it future. Let not the past be made into the future. When someone trespasses upon us, realize that we are doing this every day. Oh yes, you are. Every time you go through a door before someone else who is moving toward it, every time in traffic that you don't follow the rule of courtesy and you shut somebody out, every time you interrupt someone when they're speaking and when you really shouldn't be, every day, in every way, we are committing trespasses. Forgive us our trespasses. And if you want to be forgiven, that's perfectly obvious, then you have to forgive the trespasses that you make. And the trouble of it is we don't realize that we're making them. But every time that we do these things, and it happens a lot in spiritual life. I remember in the monastery there were two brothers, two members of the community who got into an argument, and they had a big verbal fight, great big verbal fight. I was afraid it was going to come to blows, but the two men realized where they were going, and there was a sudden silence. It all stopped, bang, like that. They both realized where this was going to go, and they weren't going to let it go any farther. I was very relieved, and I was very proud of them. And that very often has to happen. We have to just end in silence. There are a lot of peculiar twists to this business of forgiveness. I once had a roommate who was Jewish, and he had been brought up as a Jew, but he was not a practicing Jew. And we used to talk a lot about comparative religion, Christians and Jews, in their relations with each other. And he said to me one day, he said to me a very peculiar thing. He said, if Jesus Christ really was God, I should have to forgive him for what he has done to the Jews. Do you follow that? You follow what he's saying? That's tricky. He felt that Christ allowing himself to be crucified and having the blame cast on the Jews, as it was for so many centuries, was something we'd have to forgive God for. There comes the question of forgiving God. And we're not going into that this morning. I've concentrated on forgiveness amongst ourselves. Forgiving God is another subject, and so is forgiving ourselves, and I'm kind of running out of time. In that connection, the Jewish connection, I have to say that sometimes it's the injured who may have to be forgiven. I'll give you an example. In India, I worked in a school, taught in a school for Bengali boys. And one day, and the quarters in which we lived had windows open on both sides, hot climate. So open windows on both sides of my monastic cell. And one day I took my shower and left my watch and other clothes on the bed. And the bed was near enough to the window. And I didn't think about it at all, because it was the quarters of the staff, not the students. But students wandered everywhere. When I came back from my shower, the watch was gone. It wasn't a valuable watch, but it was the only one I had. And the secretary, the boss of the ashram, was sitting in his room right close by, just two rooms away. And I went to Maharaj. Some boy, there wasn't anything there but boys, some boy has taken my watch. And he looked at me with the coolest of disdain and said, why did you leave it in a place like that? And I realized that I had to be forgiven for providing the temptation to the boy. We got the watch back. But I had provided him with the temptation. And the Swami felt that that was my fault. Well, monastic life is like this. I say that you have to all be like that. That's what happened, and that's one of the twists in forgiveness. And so I come back to what I said in the beginning. The end is in what we have in the end is in my end is my beginning, as T.S. Eliot says. It's a failure, really, that we have to seek forgiveness. It's our weakness, it's our vulnerability, which we should not have. There's a Jewish proverb that says, a hero is one who makes an enemy into a friend. I don't know how they're going to do it over there. But isn't it nice that there was such a Jewish proverb? A hero is one who makes an enemy into a friend. If we keep up the attitude that we should have of constant consciousness of our true nature, if we can remind ourselves at every turn, I am not this weak, injurable, vulnerable, pathetic little caricature of a human being. I am a true human being, divine at my core, pure, unfazable in my true nature, in my essence, in my being. And I can return to that mentally through remembrance and through consciousness and through japa and through meditation again and again and again until it becomes an image which I can keep in my mind and heart and face anything that comes before me in this world with courage and without fear, without need to be forgiven. I want to finish with a little section from this book. This is Wisdom, Bliss, and Common Sense. It's one of the most practical books on spirituality that we have in our library. And this is in a Christian context, but I'm sure you will apply it for yourselves, whatever you are. The woman goes to a counselor, psychological counselor, who is the author. And this is one of her cases, her patients. Patient says, women and men lie about me. To my face they're sweet. Behind my back they run me down. People who have cheated me, they've disrespected me, and even humiliated me in front of others. Okay, says the counselor. Now tell me this. This person is a devout Christian, in fact, probably a fundamentalist. Do you believe that the Lord is omnipresent? Of course. What does that mean to you? That he's everywhere. Then is he also in the people who vilify you? Sure, he must be there, but they don't know it. That's the problem. They don't recognize him. That's their problem, not yours. They will carry their garbage to their graves. You don't need to cart their garbage to yours. I don't know what you mean. Christ said that when someone slaps your cheek, you should turn the other one too. He did not say, when someone slaps your cheek, go get your friends to pat it. When people vilify, cheat, slap, humiliate, frustrate, and lie about us, our task as true spiritual aspirants, I'll put it in, is not to observe the law of tooth for tooth and eye for eye. Patient, but I don't do anything to them in return. Yes, you do. Harboring negative feelings toward people is an action. I can't overemphasize this. Mental action is action in this world. Negative thoughts have their effect. They go out and they penetrate. Negative feelings towards people is an action. Calling someone an enemy is an action. Returning hate for hate in heart and mind is an action. Resisting evil is not the spirit-centered path. It is the way of an ego. And then she tells her what she should do, but I like the answer Swami Prabhavananda gave better than hers. He said, somebody asked him, what should I do as a monastic or a spiritual aspirant if somebody comes up and insults me or injures me? And Swami said, I visualize my Lord right away and I pray for that person to the Lord. I pray for that person right on the spot. Silently, of course. I haven't anything better to recommend, than that. Questions, comments? Floor is yours.
When you were talking, I was thinking perhaps the best thing to do would be to avoid the injury in the first place. And one way, which I use, maybe it's a bit cynical, is to try and avoid having expectations from others and for myself also, to, if something wrong happens, well, what did you expect?
That's Swami Swaminathan's answer. You go to Hollywood, you find the Swami will tell you that right away. You were expecting?
Isn't it a bit cynical, though, to not expect people to act properly or oneself?
Yes.
But I think the key is not to be attached to that expectation. Mm-hmm. See, we all have expectations, but we should not be attached to them. So if things don't turn out the way you expected, that's what Swami said.
Well, you're just using different language. It's the same thing.
But I'm not sure if it's cynical. I mean, because that's been one of the best helps for me is realizing that today's expectations are tomorrow's resentments. It almost is, you know, if I start doing it, that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it could be this idea of attachment. You know?
Yeah. But attachment. But not being attached goes a long way.
I mean, if you give up, how do you give up an attachment to an expectation?
Well, you develop a sense of detachment in your life almost all the time. I mean, that is very difficult to do.
That's right.
You see, if you don't have desires or expectations, you won't even get out of bed in the morning. You know, you have to have that. But
what Bernard means, I think, is that you have a specific expectation. You're expecting a specific reaction from somebody or a specific approach from somebody of a specific nature. And what you're saying is you have to have expectations, but they have to be like lines written on water. You can just wash them away as quickly as...
Well, when you say specific expectations, you're talking about specific goals. You know, something like that, something of that order. Even to that, we should not be attached.
Yeah.
And that is very difficult. You know, it's like Swami Bodhananda was telling us on Thursday, attachment to desires and expectations is really the problem. Developing a sense of attachment. You know, so Swami, you just said about remembering a past event. It is very easy to be detached from a past event.
It's what?
It is very easy to be, maybe for most people, to be detached from a past event, to look at it under the circumstances that people are in at that time. But if we could develop a sense of detachment in the present as things are happening, which would be the Jivan Mukta, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally detached.
Totally, yeah, right. It is very difficult. You know, that may really be the answer, it seems to me.
Are there any other questions? Any other comments?
Just a small point, but when you were talking about for giving and forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that struck me was the fact that of my family members, I'm the one that has the best memory. At least that's my opinion. But my remembrance of specifics has always been phenomenally there, even when I was small.
That's too bad, in a way.
In a way, but then what I realized was that I also don't forgive very easily,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that if I got in the business of forgiving, one of the byproducts would be forgetting, and I would find that terribly unsettling, like a real loss of control. And so, I mean, there's more to it. Seems like there's more to it than just, oh, forgive and forget. I mean, there are repercussions.
I hoped I made more to it than just forgive and forget. That was the point. And it's not an easy subject to talk about, but because the ramifications are lengthy. But this is how I look at it today. Well, let me announce that